You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalists. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and on this show we deal with the Russian Orthodox Church, specifically, and its relation to the war against the New World Order, or globalization. And today we're going to be talking about someone who's extremely important to me personally, somebody who, the study of whom I became Orthodox, and that's Archbishop Averky Taushev, who spent the latter part of his life at the Jordanville Seminary in New York. So his official title is Archbishop Averky of Syracuse. He died in 1976, and reading his work, a lot is actually in English, but I've also read a few of his non-translated things in the original. And this guy is one of the reasons that I became a member of the Old Calendarists, or True Orthodox Mission. Yes, he was a part of my conversion to Orthodoxy many, many years ago. But later on, when I was faced with the problems of the Old Calendar and the anti-ecumenical idea, it was reading Averky that changed my mind, and that made it certain that I was going to be a part of the traditionalist movement, not mainline Orthodoxy. And Averky's approach to the world is very similar to my own, and he is someone who helped mold my position, and the problem that the Russian Orthodox Church outside of Russia has now is that since they have very much gone, they've deviated from his theology to a great extent, he is being de-emphasized. Because the Synod Abroad's communion with world orthodoxy is something that he would have condemned, that he condemned in no uncertain terms, and yet this is the rector of the seminary and one of their major figures. So outside, you know, apart from the Moscow Patriarchate issue that we dealt with a week ago, there is the issue that goes along with it, and that is the communion or agreement with churches that are part of the World Council of Churches and everything else. We've got to be careful. We use words like ecumenism. It's thrown around a lot, and it isn't so much that there's any kind of dialogue with other churches, that's actually our responsibility. What ecumenism means is that the Church of God doesn't in fact exist. It has to be constructed from pieces of different elements of Christianity and even non-Christian groups. And then once that's created, that will then be the church. This is why it's a heresy. There have been many times in the past where bishops and priests have even prayed with non-Orthodox people. While that's against the canons, there may be certain reasons why that's done, like for a political reason. Against Marxism, for example, there was quite a bit of cooperation. But as a matter of course, it's condemned. So that's the concept of but that's not what we mean by ecumenism. You can't point to something that happened in the 19th century and say, well, you know, there was apparently prayer between Anglicans and Russians in the 1890s. Therefore, the Church of God doesn't exist. Obviously, that doesn't follow. We're not talking about cooperation. We're not talking about any kind of discussion. That's always been the case. We're talking about the political ideology or the religious religious ideology that says that the Church of God may have existed at one point, but doesn't exist now. It's in pieces, and that, you know, Anglicans and Catholics and whoever have a bit of it, and once we get it together, you'll have a unified, full Church of Christ the way that he envisioned it. And this is a heresy. It's a heresy. They call it a pan-heresy because, meaning overall, because it will then say that all previous heresies are okay. Everyone, if they claim to be Christian, has a bit of the truth. Being separated is more or less sinful. So once the World Council of Churches in Geneva gets us all together again, you'll finally have the Church of Christ the way it's supposed to be. But as of now, it exists only in pieces. In 1983, the Russian exiles in New York condemned this proposition. The Anglicans created the so-called branch theory. Most of you know what that is. And it's that the Church of God exists in three branches, Anglicans, Orthodoxy, and Catholics. Once it comes together and there's full intercommunion, the Church of God will then exist in its fullness. That's condemned by the Russian Orthodox Church outside of Russia. Now that church is in communion with bodies like the Greeks and the Antiochians that accept the branch theory and loudly proclaim it. And even if they don't proclaim it in public, being members of the World Council of Churches says that they do. And we all know the World Council of Churches was created by the Rockefeller family after World War II. It is a purely elite body. It's essentially a spokesperson for the a platform for the global elite on a religious realm. Archer Daniels Midland had control of the organization in the United States, but it's largely with the creation of the Rockefeller Foundation, and it has as part of its documentary history that there is no single Church of Christ. And in fact, that Christ is not necessary to salvation. Problem we have is that many Orthodox bishops have signed on to that document and are members of the World Council. You can't be a member of the World Council and reject that ridiculous idea. Bulgaria has withdrawn from it. Georgia has withdrawn from it. But they were a part of it at one time, the Moscow Patriarchate, and this is something that Archbishop Averky said over and over again, and we said this last week, is a political body. It's not really a religious body. It's a means by which the Soviet government can speak to the Christians of the world, which had a tendency to be anti-communist, and convince them that there's nothing wrong and there's no persecution in the Soviet system. The purpose of the Moscow Patriarchate, especially over the last 30, 40 years, has been to defend the Soviet Union at the World Council of Churches. To a great extent, that's really all it's done. I've read every issue of the Journal of the Moscow Patriarchate, and it is really it's hard to do. Not every syllable has been translated yet, but when Stalin died in 1953, the current patriarch, Alexei the First, called him a defender of the church, called him one of the greatest scientists who ever lived, said that he was responsive to the spiritual needs of Russians, that he was sent by God to rescue, to defend the church against the fascists. The rhetoric was so over the top from these people. It shows you what the Moscow Patriarchate really is. It's not really speaking, I mean, it's speaking to religious Russians, obviously, but also speaking to people abroad that Marxism is not anti-religious. We're a secular political body, and even people like Stalin were defenders of the faith. There are some Russian nationalists who think that he was a good guy. It's very easy to demonstrate that he was not. the records of the attacks on the church are well known in Stalin's tenure. Thousands of Christians went to their deaths under Stalin. It's true that for a while, church closings and attacks on clergy slowed, especially during the war, since the secret police had other things to do in fighting the Germans at the time. And this is somehow taken as that, you know, Stalin was this Christian man. He was nothing of the sort. I have seen an icon of Stalin, but that is, I think, largely a joke, just like the stupid icon of Hitler. There is a claim, a man, Oleg Platonov, who is a man I respect in many other ways, says that church building went out of control under Stalin. The church had this renaissance. And it's simply not the case. Churches were closed and brought under attack under Stalin, as they always were, just with less enthusiasm. It's true, on the territory of the Soviet Union, churches were constructed, and monasteries formed, and everything else. No one bothers to mention that that's in German-occupied territory. Yes, technically it's part of the Soviet Union, but they use that, you know, in the Soviet Union, church construction was tremendous under Stalin, which of course is true, except that it wasn't under Stalin, it was under Hitler. Now, Averky was the conscience of the Russian exiles. He was very politically minded and very ethnically minded. He realized, because he bothered to read the Old Testament, that the church is always very political. Now, what we mean by political, we're not talking about campaigns and elections. Political means concerning issues of justice, our life as a community. Those issues, justice, epistemology, philosophy, theology, economics, these aren't radically different. They all come under Christ's saving power, and they were all dealt with in depth in the Old Testament. Metropolitan Anastasi was extremely sympathetic to Adolf Hitler and saw the Third Reich not just as a bulwark against Stalin, but as, you know, the savior of Christendom. And I have quoted him all over my website, talking about just how important Hitler is to the resurrection of Christendom in the West, that his new order, so to speak, is in fact a just one. Those have not been translated by Metropolitan Anastasi and of course Metropolitan Seraphim Laid, who I've dealt with on this show a long time ago, was Metropolitan of the Russian Orthodox Church under Hitler. In fact, his title was the, you know, Chief Bishop of the Reich, regardless of how far it extended. So as large as the Reich was, he was the head of the church in that distance. Remained a part of the Synod abroad for his whole life, and he died in full communion with the Russian church. And so the notion of, you know, there was nothing about National Socialism, certainly, that's anti-Christian. Quite the opposite. It is one of the, you know, it fits the Old Testament model of good governance better than any other system. By far, you know, it is the Christian philosophy. You could be a National Socialist and not necessarily be a Hitlerian, in the same sense that you can be a communist and not be a Stalinist. No one's perfect. But this was the position of the Russian Orthodox Church abroad, Anastasi. But that has been swept under the rug since the war ended. The fact that Hitler lost made this very inconvenient. The Seraphim Laid, which was the head of the German church under Hitler, was extremely pro-Hitler, brought Hitler quite a bit of intelligence against the Soviets and was very instrumental in, and he did create a renaissance in the Russian church in the Reich. He was a part of the church abroad and was a celebrated part of the church abroad right until his death. So anyone who, any Orthodox people who are going to condemn National Socialism, then has to condemn Metropolitan Anastasi, the entire Ukrainian church at the time. In fact, in Europe, the Orthodox Church, regardless of its background, saw Hitler as a positive force, with, of course, the exception of the church under Stalin. The entire Ukrainian church saw Hitler as, you know, the harbinger of a new order. And same thing for Anastasi. So it's not like these people saw Hitler as a just a hammer to use against Stalin. They went farther than that. And I have all of this on my website. And it's extremely important to remember this. National Socialism is the Christian ideology, so to speak. In the abstract, this is as close to the, you know, law and Deuteronomy and the prophets that you can get. And unfortunately, there's been some writing on this, but certainly not sufficiently. And since no one reads the Old Testament, very few people know this. Archbishop Averky really helped form my views on Russia, because the notion of Russia being the religious capital of the world was essential to his view. He has one of his best articles. I don't know if this is in English or not. What is Russia's destiny? And he sees it the same way I do. Russia is a battleground between good and evil. Russia is, right, we'll put it this way. Russia is with the exception of the Soviet Union, of course, Russia is the force against the Antichrist, the Roman Empire. The Soviet Union and Russia have nothing in common. The Soviet Union was anti-Russian. It persecuted the Russian culture. And Stalin himself said that there are too many Russians in Russia, and they shouldn't have a privileged position in terms of language and everything else. There is no such thing as Russian culture without the church. The church created Russian culture. There is no such thing. So you can't defend Russian culture and be an atheist and a persecutor of the church at the same time. But nations as a whole, you know, the word nation comes up in the New Testament 1,000 times. Nations have missions. They have things that they do, but their experience, their geographic position, sort of population they have, is such that they have a specialty. They have an aspect of themselves that can contribute to the overthrowing of evil and the creation of a new world in Christ's second coming. Nations are the extension of families. They are bonded geographically, historically, and genetically, speaking the same language, again, in the broad sense of that word. Nationalism in that sense is not only a part of the Orthodox Church, a part of natural law, and no one ever rejected that concept. The secular state is another matter. And when people, what happens when you're fighting someone about nationalism is what they do. Father John Whiteford did this recently, and it was very disappointing. The tendency is they define nationalism however they want, and it's usually something very negative. So they'll define it in this like the worship of DNA or something stupid like that. And then they'll pat themselves on the back for condemning it. So they invent this phantom, which they say nationalism is, and then very piously condemn it. But the way Averky understood it was a unity of a people within a single language and religion, in a single territory, that over time develops a mission, a purpose, something that they and only they do. And Russia's is to build, you know, social justice to the point that it become the bulwark against the New World Order. And he did use the phrase or something similar to that during his lifetime. That when Christ took human nature, he didn't just take those aspects of human nature that are congenial to liberalism. He took it all, the state, the nation, the economy. The fact that the word nation is used over and over again, and it's only used as ethnos, as a very specific group of people, back up what Averky is doing. And of course, in the Old Testament, both in the law and the prophets, the Israelite nation is both an ethnic and a religious category. And back then, they did not make a distinction between those two things, because you really couldn't have an ethnic group without a common belief. There is no nation without a common religion. Russia is a bulwark against Antichrist. All institutions, nations, families, they're to be saved no differently than the individual. The individual is an invention of the modern world. It doesn't exist. No individual can function 5 seconds without the community. As I said before, when a baby is born, he is completely helpless. He'd be dead almost immediately without his parents. In fact, it couldn't exist without his parents. So it's absurd to talk about the isolated individual. There is no such thing. There are families, there are communities, there are guilds, there are nations, there are civilizations, there are regions. But there are no individuals, and there's certainly no such thing as the international community. All institutions will be saved. And you could say the same thing for the ethnic group and the church. I'm being very careful here. The state, as this administration, is not what people mean or what the ancients meant when they said church and state. You know, they would never use such a modern term. But church and state, to be vulgar about it, is Christ's human nature and divine nature. People today are so dumb and so debased that they think church and state refers to bishops and the administration of government. That's not what it means. The state is the Constitution. The Constitution is buried in the ethnos. That's where it comes from. It's part of the soil, almost literally. It's what makes a people a people. And of course, the church is the presence of God on earth. So when you say church and state, because Americans and what are so debased and don't know what these terms mean, they think it's just bishops and the administration. That's absurd. Just like politics isn't about campaigns and elections. Christ was very political in the true sense of the word, because he continued to affirm the truth of the Old Testament, especially the prophets, who he imitated and he quoted from. The Third Rome, in Averroes' point of view, is the true end of history. It is a just social order with an independent church. Now he's there talking about actual bishops and monasteries. Justice, the ethnos, or the race, and Christ's presence on earth, or grace, are all to be integrated into a single community, a single civilization. To theorize this is one of Russia's great intellectual missions. But to have a just social order that you would find in the book of Deuteronomy, for example, the prophets are referring to, the National Socialism speaks of, in full integration of God's grace, which is just his presence or energy on earth. The Antichrist will come, and one of the things that he will do is talk about restoring Christianity to its true form. The New World Order is the highest expression of Antichrist. The World Council of Churches is a religious element of that. It is the full artificial and abstract unification of all nations into a single amorphous blob of isolated individuals overseen by an oligarchy. Families don't really exist. Nations don't really exist. The only thing that exists is the abstract individual and the abstract international community and abstract human rights. These inventions of the mind, they do exist, but actual concrete functional institutions do not. Social justice and the independent church integrated into one unity, which is what Christ's life was, Chalcedon, two independent natures. That is Russia's mission intellectually. With the Antichrist in a religious form will talk about this restoration of the ancient church, and people are so ignorant that they'll take his word for it. The Antichrist is expressed in the New World Order. An atheist, materialist, amorphous domination of the globe by this combination of public and private entities that meet in things like, you know, Bohemian Grove and Bilderberg meetings and all this. It doesn't have to be an actual individual. As I've said before, the Jewish elite are Antichrist, literally so, collectively speaking. And since Adam Kadmon is this a new man that they're going to create, that is the individual. A single individual cannot rule the world. A single individual would be immediately seen by anyone, even secular people, as Antichrist. Demons are not so stupid as to be so obvious about it, having one individual ruling everything. No one would accept that. No one would tolerate that. There's no way that could be the case. It's a group of people who work as one man. That's what Antichrist is, and its highest expression is this New World Order. Therefore, anyone who supports any aspect of it cannot even remotely be Christian. I'm not even talking about grace anymore. There's no way they could even use the term. And because there's such a separation of the Old and the New Testaments, and the way Christians and even Orthodox people think today, they don't understand this. They believe that politics, in this vague sense, is something the church shouldn't talk about. Actors and you know, ignorant politicians, they could talk about that, who know nothing. But the church, who actually has the truth of the matter, may not. There are theologians right now teaching in universities that have barely read the Old Testament. But politics in terms of campaigns and elections, political parties, that, Averke says, is really none of our business, and who cares, because they don't have power anyway. That will certainly not save us. Policies and laws written down on paper will not save anybody. Social justice is to be found on the institutional level. And the concept of freedom is to be found in our internal freedom from passion. Passions are these things like anger and greed that get us to do completely irrational things. Lust is probably the greatest one today, because men will say anything, do anything, be anything in order to get the attention of attractive women. To be enslaved to this is the very opposite of freedom. Freedom is never just to do whatever you want. If that were the case, no one would be free, because the passions would rule completely. And of course, the age of the Antichrist, which is now, the regime is able to harness those passions and offer to meet them for a fee. Since people have no control over their passions, it's the ultimate marketing ploy. They're never satisfied. They're almost irresistible. There's no control over them. So whoever can harness that for a profit will rule entirely and completely. E. Michael Jones speaks of this at great length in his Libido Dominandi, one of the great books of recent memory. Freedom refers to an internal state of autonomy. It's not to do whatever you want. But this Antichrist system, who rules by controlling passions, who rules by offering to satisfy these passions for a fee, who rules by promising to satisfy them forever, will realize that there is one threat to his existence: a resurrected Russia and an Orthodox Church that recognizes him for what he is. The Protestants and Catholics will be looking for this individual, some guru that they think is going to take over and rule the world in Jerusalem or something. We have to understand this symbolically. A single individual with that kind of power is simply impossible. There's no way to rule a family by yourself, let alone the planet. So if there actually would be an individual who's Antichrist, they would still need a massive administration. So it's always a collective now. But when you have the Jewish elite who function as one man and who posit a new man with a name, Adam Kadmon, This is what we're talking about. I'll say it again. Demons will not be so obvious to have a single individual man, person, as Antichrist. It is a single body of elite Jews at the head of the New World Order, profiting the most from the New World Order, giving the ideological background to it, healing the world, so to speak, the Tikkun Olam that's at the center of all Jewish politics. But it will recognize the true Orthodox Church, that is, the Orthodox Church that understands what the New World Order is, understands what Antichrist is, understands what freedom is, and is apart from any kind of ecumenical body, holding to everything that the synods and the church fathers and everything held. That is the only threat, the single solitary threat to Antichrist. The root of the word Satan, which has many meanings, it comes from Set, the god Set in Egypt. It means opponent, an aggressive opponent, but it also means slanderer. Well, those two are similar because it's opponent of what? It's the opponent of reality. It's the opponent and the attacker of truth. Truth is reality. Because of the nominalist heresy, words create the world, not reality. Whoever defines those words and gives them meaning then tells people what is real and what is not. If words create the world and someone can define words, then that someone can define reality by definition. We are at war without question, and this was Averky's, probably his central point as far as church life is concerned. We are at war with the New World Order, the expression of Antichrist, and one of its most obnoxious manifestations, of course, is the Soviet Union. Destroying Russia, removing its wealth, breaking its will is absolutely essential for the New World Order to function, and so far it's failed. Remember something, the New World Order is not all-powerful. Demons are actually quite weak. Christ defeated them. It's in every single church service. Don't overestimate their power. Demons have power because the elites enthrone them. Demons have power because we give in to our passions rather than to reason. Demons can only rule by the manipulation of images. Images that they put in front of you that block reality. Words that are defined and redefined and redefined by those who have the power and interest to do so. Demons rule only in one way. And you see this in St. Anthony the Great. Images, and what I really mean by that is fantasies. You think of yourself wealthy and how easy your life is going to be. How women will flock to you. You fantasize about attractive women. We all know how that goes. We fantasize about having, you know, the perfect car or the perfect job. And you realize that none of these fantasies are true. First of all, because they're images. They're the creation of someone else. Number two, when you do achieve these things, it's not nearly as good as you thought. And actually, you get sick of it really fast. And maybe it's not what you want. These images are very simplistic things. And of course, number three, and most importantly, that they're never satisfied. You can have all the women in the world and still not be satisfied. You could have all the money in the world. Usually people like that don't just retire. They continue to amass more money and more power. We are at war with the New World Order, which is materialist by its very construction. Our peace is to be found in war with this body. Peace and war are not opposites, in fact, because we can be at war with the New World Order and continue to have internal peace. But peace and freedom are almost identical in the sense that if we control our passions, we will have peace. Autonomy and peace are one and the same thing. anyone who talks about peace with this world order is an enemy. There could be no peace with it whatsoever. We certainly judge it in the true sense of the word because Christ judges it, because the fathers judge it. We're not personally condemning it. That's not our personal decision. We're doing it because Christ did it. And yes, we can judge, and we will judge, because Christ has done exactly the same. The prophets have done exactly the same. Slander is the other definition for Satan. But a slanderer is nothing but an inverter, someone who takes reality and substitutes what you think your own self-interest is in its place. To slander somebody is to slander, for example, to create images in front of your mind as to what the church is. People who are anti-Christian overwhelmingly have no idea what Christianity is. 99% of the time, and this is, you know, I do this quite often, when I'm debating somebody, most of the time, almost all of the time, I'm explaining to them that what they think the church is in fact a caricature. Part of it comes from the press, part of it comes from universities, part of it comes from their own imagination. This is what we mean when we say Satan is a slanderer. To slander something is to fight the truth of it. When someone hates the church, they have an image in front of their mind that they're fighting. Images create emotions. The truth produces joy in the sense of satisfaction. You know, the word joy is an odd word to use in English. You know, what we really mean is a very peaceful satisfaction, which is the end, in a secular sense, the end of our lives. You can only find that in freedom, since passions will never leave you alone. And once you are at peace with yourself because of that, you have no choice but to be at war with the New World Order. Being at war is, in fact, one of the ways that we keep peace with ourselves and one another. Most people that we come across are deluded. Mavrky was extremely stressed this to a great extent. They don't know what they mean. People get emotional because they have an image in front of them. They talk about National Socialism. They have this image of a gas chamber. And they talk about the church. They have the image of this overbearing father or something like that. It's a slander because it isn't real. People do what they do because they are enslaved to the passions. The passions, of course, exist by creating an image, this fantasy of what it's going to be like once we get it. And it never turns out that way. And in fact, you can't be satisfied with it. You won't be. And the human mind isn't programmed for this. The human mind is programmed for a satisfaction that lasts forever. And a truth that doesn't change. So in Averky's article, The Satanic Nature of Rebellion, and really what it means is the satanic nature of revolution, is that it comes from people with these fake images in front of their faces. They honestly believe that if they kill enough clergy, all working people will be equal with one another and satisfied. Well, the only way you can believe something so idiotic, because even the communists didn't believe that, is to have these distorted images in front of you. These are delusions. These are slanders. They're lies. Lucifer rebelled. God did not reveal his full nature to angels, or else there could be no rebellion, because God will never make anyone be his friend. He will always offer free choice because free choice is concomitant with reason. Reason would make no sense unless you had a free choice, but a free choice is based on autonomy, not abstract freedom. Lucifer rebelled, I mean, you know, in a simple sense because he wasn't in charge. He was so extraordinary. And also that Christ was going to become man. And therefore flesh would one day be deified. Flesh, which to an angel, of course, is far, far lower than their own nature, will then be higher than them as it's deified. Christ is in a glorified body on God's right hand. Therefore, human flesh, in that sense, is now part of the Trinity. This is something that Lucifer could not handle. To him, flesh is disgusting. You read about demonic possessions. One of the things the demon always says is how disgusting you are. You have feces and urine and digestive juices and everything else. And they attack the human person for this. This happens in almost every possession case. Because the flesh is disgusting to them. They are of a different nature, although demons are now something less than purely immaterial. You know, the difference between material and immaterial isn't radical. There are many gradations in between. One of the things that Averki says is that the fall of Adam from the garden, which really was about power, to have power over things, because he was given an image, a fantasy that was put in his mind, that what it would be like if he was able to rule things rather than just exist and cooperate with them. And you had the exact same thing with Lucifer. At some point, even one of the greatest of the archangels had a image of what it would be like if he were, in fact, to rule heaven. Dostoevsky says, if we lived in paradise, we would be bored out of our minds and immediately destroy it. Revolutions are the same thing. We talk about something being based on a passion, we mean it's being based on an image. An image that is designed to evoke our lowest, most primal feelings. It'd be power or you know, whatever. You know, money, and you could even say lust, is ultimately about power. On the other hand, he makes reference to St. Vladimir's conversion of Russia and his own personal conversion. That was, in fact, revolutionary, but only in the sense that he removed the old images. Vladimir personally was very frightened of his new conversion. He was afraid he was going to do something wrong and lose his soul. And here's a case where you have a monarch who truly believed in the Orthodox faith that he received from the Bulgarians. Very few people spoke Greek, so it wasn't from Byzantium, it was ultimately from Bulgaria. And he had an image of hell in his mind, the state that he might be in. In that particular case, it was a true image. It was reality. He simply had reality in front of his mind. And as a result of this, he would invite beggars to the palace on a regular basis. Carts filled with food were brought through Kiev and elsewhere to feed the indigent. He was truly afraid, and he actually eventually at one point wrote the Patriarch of Constantinople asking for guidance as to what he can do and what he couldn't do, including the notion of capital punishment, which he was going to ban. But what St. Vladimir did is in fact the very nature of old Russia. Averki says that charity in the true sense and lengthy prayer services are the hallmark of the Russian church. Well, lengthy prayer service is nothing more than to try to immerse yourself in the truth for as long as humanly possible, knowing full well that when you leave church, you will then be assaulted by images, many of which you won't be able to resist. When he talks about the satanic nature of revolutions, he, of course, talks about the Jews. And he makes it very, very clear that they are the closest to Lucifer's rebellion. Because in rejecting Logos, they reject the notion that there is, in fact, this broad, overarching purpose to the natural order based around one spiritual entity. They then declared themselves at war with Logos. Nature then became this dead, meaningless entity that then they had the authority to remake as they please. That's a very, very brief sketch of Jewish history since Christ. And so Philo of Alexandria tried to say that actual words in the vibrations that we speak, this is at the root of objects in space. That the words that God uttered still exist in the vibrations that all objects have. That's how far they were willing to go to try to dethrone Logos as it informs nature. And that's where you get the gematria and everything else, where actual words, numbers, and letters have power, since they, when spoken, have vibrations. This is not at the core of so-called name worship, which is a completely different thing altogether. This is not what name worship ever is. No one actually believes that the vibrations that you speak when you say the word of God is identical to God in the same sense that the Eucharist would be. No one believes that. In fact, you know, the leaders of that movement, Ilidor and Anthony Bulatovich, condemn it in no uncertain terms, that no one believes that. If you believe that, you should be an institution, not just a heretic. But no one actually believes that. But it is central to the Jewish idea, and you see it in Philo. The notion of giving you a good vibe or something like that, good vibrations, all this is part of the Jewish idea that there is no logos, there is no purpose. And remember, when they say God, they're referring to themselves. Jews don't believe in God as, you know, God the Father. They reject that completely because they reject logos. Because logos has to have a source, and that is the Father. They are, in fact, as an entity, as one man, God, and their own savior. Now, Archbishop Averky wrote and spoke on, as we talked about last week, the Moscow Patriarchate. That is to say, a small church body that Stalin had authorized in between 1943 and 1945, largely as a political body. But just as in both Vitali and Averky didn't see this as a church, it's not a matter of whether it's true or false. It's that it's not a church at all. That's not its purpose. Again, I'm talking about at that era. For the same reason, the USSR is not a government. There are Protestants out there, actually by the millions, who will say that Paul in the book of Romans says you have to obey government, no matter what it is. And of course, Paul says quite explicitly that the government has to be from God. If that rider wasn't included, any biker gang who takes over a town then would be, you would have to obey out of conscience because God has done this. Governments aren't just whoever has the most guns. Only postmodern positivists could believe that. That's part of the nominalist idea. It's not just who has the most guns. Government in the true sense is the enforcing of natural law. There's absolutely no reason to obey just whoever, you know, happens to take power at the moment. The USSR, therefore, makes no laws. These are arbitrary decrees. We certainly have no choice but to obey government. But that's the same thing as saying that we live in reality and have to strive for the truth. A law is not something that a Congress will pass. That's not what law meant in the ancient world, medieval world. That's not what it meant. Law and justice have the same root. It's a state. It's a state of affairs. So an illegitimate government, whether it be the banking oligarchy in Florence, the banking oligarchy in the United States, or the Soviet Union. These aren't governments, and they don't pass laws. They are, in fact, at war with governments and despise the notion of law. Only the postmodern American will actually believe that a law is something that the powerful write down on paper. That's how debased the modern American is. And you have Protestants blaspheming by claiming this is what Paul meant. The very fact in saying that you obey those who wield the sword itself is a spiritual figure and implies the truth. This refers to recognizing logos and the truth in the world and removing and destroying the images that we create, that demons create, that the Jews create. a government is from God in the fact that it recognizes this. Otherwise, it's from us. A man-made authority never has to be obeyed. We may have to obey it strategically now and again, keep our heads. But as a matter of course, and certainly as a matter of conscience, modern governments, of being almost entirely illegitimate, do not have to be obeyed at any level whatsoever. And when the Moscow Patriarchate referred to Stalin as a new prophet, a new Moses, a new David, you realize that, of course, this is not a government in any normal sense of the word. This is not a church in any normal sense of the word. As I've said many, many times, God's presence is not dependent on whether or not your bishop is competent. It isn't a matter of there being grace. It's a matter of whether it functions or is even meant to function as a church. Anybody could do the liturgy if they wanted to. Anyone could put icons up in their house. It doesn't make them bishops. It doesn't make them clergy. Someone could recite the creed. It doesn't automatically make them Orthodox people. Now, as my listeners know, we were in absolutely no position to judge Metropolitan Sergius, the man who, in his declaration in 1927, attached the church to the Soviet regime as a matter of conscience and as a matter of doctrine. He did it to save himself. He did it to save thousands of clergy. Now, the clergy were killed anyway. But we can't judge that since we've never been threatened with the Gulag before. But he also said that Stalin was the spiritual father of the Russian people. It is true that the Moscow Patriarchate gave information as where the underground Christians were and were a part of the rooting out of the true Orthodox Church that existed underground. It's not a church in any sense, although its members certainly may have the grace of God. God is not necessarily dictated to by the competence or even the existence of bishops or clergy. But if we're speaking of it as an institution, then it is a bureaucratic invention. It calls itself a church, but it has no, it doesn't, you know, I could call my cat a church if I wanted to. It doesn't make her a group of icons. It is true that the Moscow Patriarchate did canonize the new martyrs. It did eliminate the anathemas on the old believers. And it's true that it canonized the royal family. And all of this is true. And there are many, many people in that body that venerate them and have the grace of God with them for that reason. But this was overwhelmingly for public pressure. That generation that came to power under the communists is dying off now. You do have younger traditionalists coming into authority in that body. It does not make them a legitimate church body, though. It does, however, show that God is not constrained by whether or not your bishop is a fool. The notion of a church body, though, we're not talking about an institution at all. We're talking about the singularity of God's presence on earth, bringing people to it. This is what a parish is. This is what a monastery is. Because we have bodies and we need to see and hear, we construct houses and we construct institutions. But that's radically secondary to grace. Grace is merely God's presence on earth, his power, his energy. Grace is a word that's so wildly overused, I don't like using it anymore. In fact, it's the same thing as grace. Energy and light. These are all one and the same thing. It's not God as such. It is his presence and his power. That's all that a church is. That's all that a parish is or a monastery is. Participating in that is what prayer is. This is why overstressing institutions is such an error and such a problem. God is not going to condemn those who went to Moscow Patriarchate churches because they didn't know any better, because they were afraid of going underground, or if they didn't even know who was legitimate and who wasn't, because of the propaganda that was constantly coming out. They're given all the graces they need for salvation. God is not a monster. So when Averky is talking about the Moscow Patriarchate having no grace, all he means is, and that it's not even a church. And Vitali says the same thing. St. Philaret of New York says the same thing. And the World Council of Churches, it's its primary purpose. We said that last week. These are all absolutely essential axioms of the Russian Orthodox Church in exile, Russian Orthodox Church outside of Russia. For that reason, he also condemns the idea of the letter of the law. I've said this many times, I'll say it many more times. The truth cannot be reduced to words on paper. Words on paper come into existence because there's a problem that has to be solved. Words can be manipulated. Words can be misunderstood. Words are very far from reality, no matter how close to it you might be. Words, it's often very difficult for words to speak the truth. But to reduce church doctrine to words is a blasphemy. As if, the creed is in fact the faith. Now, it is a manifestation of the faith in highly abbreviated form. As word meanings change so radically over time, the truth has to be understood in different ways. And the church, of course, employs many, many different ways for the same truth to be apprehended. But institutions, and when I say institutions, words are, in fact, institutions. These are limited entities. They're often very unstable. You know, church bodies as such, especially in the 20th century and what we've had the 21st century so far, are extremely unstable entities. This has nothing to do with the church in the true sense, as God's light and his presence on earth, which is simply a singular entity. It doesn't change. It doesn't move, in a sense. And anyone who believes and acts within the Orthodox tradition has to be, by definition, participating in that light, because you couldn't have this truth otherwise. You would have no reason. And it's something that I said last week, and the Synod Abroad, so many other groups say, no one has any interest in becoming Orthodox. Absolutely no one. It's a very difficult life. It will get you condemned by the regime. And importantly, you now have a bullseye on your back because demons will attack you. But when I was ordained, Metropolitan said, you will come under a vicious demonic attack soon. After I was ordained, of course. And of course, my divorce and everything else is exactly what that was. It can only be explained by demonic power. Everyone will have their own attack. Everyone will have their own amount of suffering. Orthodox people who don't suffer aren't Orthodox. Because our knowledge of the faith and our connection to it exists only when we are torn from it. Only when our lives are ripped apart. At least in that case, we have to put them back together with the church in mind. Nothing of the old man, nothing of the old Adam, nothing of your old personhood can remain. Because that person was hardwired to sin, especially if you're born and raised in the modern West. The letter of the law is a starting point. For someone who doesn't know anything about the church, you could read a list of rules. Well, following them or accepting them isn't the point. It's the spirit behind them. It's why they exist, and understanding why they exist, and understanding that they're highly limited. And the last point I'm going to make before I go, Averky, like so many others, stated that that concept of Orthodox monarchy is dogma. An Orthodox person, at some level or another, must be a monarchist. And this is because how God has created the universe, the father of the family, and how many times he talks about his representative on earth, which in the Middle Ages was the monarch. Don't touch my anointed, you see in Psalm 104. Never, never attack or slander the king. Ecclesiasticus,